So what Mr. LaRouche has been laying out in the recent period is that what we're looking at is a disintegration of an international financial system. And he's emphasized that what we have to do is we have to make a transition from thinking in terms of economy in monetary terms, okay, even from the standpoint of the best standpoint, where in the past, under the American system of economics, you would have national sovereignty, the power to generate internally in a nation direct credit for the physical development of the nation. LaRouche says that that's required. We require this shift back to implementation beginning from the United States to a Glass-Steagall protection of the commercial banking system. The result of that being wiping out the financial values that are purely speculative as the first step towards extending this kind of protection into Europe, Germany, France, Italy, at which point you can begin to free Russia from their cohabitation with these same kind of predatory speculative circles, at which point you're talking about the capability of bringing in China and India as well. So LaRouche says that's the immediate political battle that we have to win in terms of that shift in policy. But he says the longer-term perspective is taking up a more challenging question, which is how do you actually plan an economy from the standpoint of physical considerations? And he suggested that there is two elements that should be focused on in this. Number one, he said, look at the role that Dmitry Mendeleev, Russian chemist, who discovered what people were exposed to at a certain amount in their education as the periodic table of chemical elements. What he, the background for doing this was actually the necessity for Russia to undergo a complete economic transformation, and Mendeleev was actually in the middle of that process. And Mendeleev was a student at a place called the Main Pedagogical Institute in St. Petersburg, which is an institute that has had people in it, and I assume also today still has people in it, that go back in terms of intellectual influence to the ideas of Gottfried Leibniz, reflecting the battle that Leibniz was engaged with to actually bring this conception that he developed, the idea of a physical economy. LaRouche has cited that Leibniz's essay, "This Society and Economy," is sort of the founding document of this conception of physical economy. Well, what Leibniz was doing was laying out how to bring this conception, where you take a population, you have a people who are making scientific advances, and basically creating the ability through scientific discoveries and inventions, the development of new technologies, actually developing nations physically. And Leibniz was, one of the projects Leibniz was engaged with was the ability to do that, what had been done by the École Polytechnique in France under Colbert, to bring this same conception into Russia. So we had an alliance with Tsar Peter the Great. So you had also the same ideas coming out of Leibniz that fed into what became the American Revolution. What Benjamin Franklin is doing in the 1700s is part of these networks. So in the century in which Mendeleev lives, you have a period after the War of 1812, the 1815 period, the Treaty of the Congress of Vienna, where there basically is a crushing by British Empire factions of a lot of this nation-building activity, including inside Russia. Okay, for the early period inside the United States, similarly, you have periods where you have people that represent this idea of the American system of economics, people like Henry Clay, people later like Henry Carey, who is the economic advisor to Abraham Lincoln. But in the United States, that political faction doesn't really get the upper hand until you get the election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860. So you have a similar fight inside Russia. In the case of Russia, you have a faction associated with Tsar Alexander II and a whole series of people around Alexander II that are in direct connection with these networks in the United States of Henry Carey. So from 1855, when Alexander II is power in Russia, the concern of Russia is how do you maintain a freedom to actually have this kind of industrial development perspective inside Russia, and they realize that that cannot be done unless you defeat the British Empire. So in 1855, the Russians offer to give Alaska to America from the standpoint of, you know, developing the capability of this collaboration, the development of projects like the Bering Strait Tunnel. Mendeleev is a student at this main pedagogical institute in St. Petersburg from 1850 until 1855, where he's influenced in particular by a person by the name of Voskresensky, who is known as the grandfather of Russian chemistry, and who is known for developing a pedagogy in terms of getting people working through the battle over ideas, which would mean in terms of what are the ideas of Leibniz, what are the ideas of Kepler, what are the ideas from this whole current of humanist science, and how do we move those ideas forward today? So you have this whole period that in 1861 you have Tsar Alexander II liberates 26 million serfs in Russia. 2 years before Abraham Lincoln is in a position where he launches the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing the slaves in the United States, both in Russia and in the United States. This is a battle against the British Empire, but it's also a tremendous physical economic challenge. How do you run an economy? In the United States, Lincoln had the perspective that he was engaged in the projects that, during the American Civil War and following it, building the transcontinental railways across the United States, which were completed in 1869, the same year that Dmitry Mendeleev published his first version of his periodic system of the chemical elements. Lincoln had this whole conception that you have to defeat this British insurrection in the United States, but then follow this up with an industrial development, infrastructure development of the United States in the South. And you have a similar kind of orientation in Russia that Mendeleev is involved in. Mendeleev is someone who was fighting for this idea of against the British free trade in Russia, for this idea of the American system approach. And there's actually a very interesting a statement by Mendeleev in this respect, where he says, with respect to what do you do with, for example, these 26 million serfs that have been freed, he said, well, obviously they cannot all become farmers, but if you think about it, isn't it possible to dig deeper in the earth instead of becoming a farmer to become a miner? So at the time that Mendeleev was during this period, he by 1855. Let me just move on to the next thing here. Okay. Okay, so at the time that Mendeleev graduated from this pedagogical institute in St. Petersburg, the one of the central conceptions, sort of axiomatic assumptions, you might say, underlying the practice of chemistry, was this this conception of a chemical element. So this, you know, poses the question of, you know, what is a chemical element? And I propose we sort of investigate this from the standpoint of thinking of the history of the development of mankind. You know, ever since human beings have existed on this planet, we've existed from the standpoint of using our power of creative discovery to develop discoveries of physical principle that allow us to increase our power to change the universe for our benefit. Okay, man in that sense is able to do something that no other animal can do. Okay, if you consider...
Excuse me, Bob, could you move a little bit away from the light so we can see you? Okay. Okay.
So this conception of what an element is has to be thought of from the standpoint of not any sort of objective view that man is an observer on the universe, looking at the universe objectively, but from the standpoint of how man, through his power to make discoveries of universal physical principles, develops the capability having materials that increase his power to exist. If you examine the first discovery in human history, which is probably the ability of man to use fire, this was a discovery that allowed man to totally change the relationship he had to his environment, to be able to, you know, scare away animals, to be able to cook them for food, to be able to, you know, have some element of security. And also the idea that his mind was able to by making a discovery in this way, redefine what he was as a man. So in that sense, since the conception of universe does not exist for any animal, universe, you know, is a unifying in your mind, the principles that govern that give you the power to increase your power in the universe. So in that sense, you can say that fire is a element of the human mind, the ability of the human beings to make such truthful discoveries of universal physical principle. But since the human mind is where the conception of the universe exists, it doesn't exist anywhere else, then you can also say that fire is an element of the universe itself. So if you think about what, through this prehistory of man's development, must have been the case, that there were, in fact, four elements. No, that's not that. That's not the one. Is it not in the right order here? Yeah. Okay. The four elements that I'm sure everyone has heard of before, that today might sound, well, this is sort of old stuff that, you know, that nobody believes in that today. But think about how mankind actually developed. Okay, first the discovery of fire in itself. So you're talking about fire physically in terms of something that that you can touch with the fire in terms of the power of the human mind to make such discoveries, then you're also concerned, you know, what do you see in front of you? You see, you know, physically fire consuming some solid material, you know, some wood, okay, producing some form of air, okay. So you're looking at, you know, what are the transformations going on underlying this phenomena that I'm looking at that is very important to actually allow me to have a future. Okay, and these terms, you know, initially might have meant in that sense, but as man made more and more discoveries, these terms fire, air, water would take on other connotations as well. Okay, consider also the question of man making discoveries of physical principle, not just on the planet Earth, but asking. Yeah, this is basically what I was saying here. Okay, also. Also, you know, what was a key a determinant of the development of mankind was man's ability and necessity to master the lawfulness of the processes with respect to astronomy. Okay, particularly if you consider the fact that mankind has existed on this earth probably somewhere between 2 million and 5 million years, and during that time period there have been periodic glaciations. So man, to secure his development, would have to understand not only short-term astronomical cycles. You know, the first obvious one would be the cycle of day and night, the lawfulness underlying, you know, how the stars are passing overhead at night, the development of the discovery of the planetary systems, the movement of the planets with respect to the constellations of the fixed stars, but also the longer cycles in terms of having an understanding of this. And if you think about what's involved there, you have the same fire, the sun, water, earth, and obviously air. So this conception of what an element is, I think, has to be looked at from that standpoint in terms of man's battle to actually discover what is universal about the nature of transformations in the universe. So you have this. Yeah. So you have, for example, you know, physical fire. Okay, you have two kinds of phenomena that are apparent to you. You have, on the one hand, you know, you start with some wood or a tree, okay, some material apparent object, okay, and you have fire with the heat and the light associated with this, and this physical object you can touch is transformed from being a huge mass of a tree into a tiny mass of charcoal or ashes, and you see also a certain amount of smoke. So this, you know, poses certain questions: what's really going on here? Okay, first of all, off you have these two different category of phenomena. Okay, what material in terms of what you can touch, what has weight, and the other category of phenomena being in terms of what has, you know, the heat and the light, okay, appear to be, you know, a totally different kind of phenomena. What's really going on here? Is matter being simply destroyed, okay, or is matter being transformed directly into the light, into the heat? Or is there some sort of different, some combination of those two things going on? What's the lawfulness behind this? And for much of mankind's history, the idea basically actually was that matter was being destroyed in these kind of reactions, because you would say, okay, well, I have this big mass of wood that I'm starting with, and what I'm left with is this tiny amount of ash or charcoal, and you see a certain amount of smoke going up into the air, but you say, well, that's not very heavy. That all what I see doesn't add up to what I started with. But then there's also this other question of the light and the heat. What's the relationship between the two? So as Mendeleev in the textbook on chemistry that he wrote called Principles of Chemistry, which he actually wrote in, this is 1868 to 1871, I believe, and he writes it from the standpoint of being able to basically make accessible to large number of people a mastery of the principles of chemistry for the purpose of the development of Russia, okay, as I said before in terms of his conception. He said that it was only up in the 15th to the 16th century when people realized that in such reactions that invisible gases were produced by combustion, that these not only, in spite of the fact that you couldn't see them, that they existed, that you could weigh them, and that these are the kind of experiments that people like Antoine Lavoisier was involved in, where what you would determine, Lavoisier did these kind of experiments where you would he would start with a certain amount, a certain weight of wood, for example, or carbon, burn it in a controlled fashion in air, and collect all of the gases, all of the smoke, and then actually weigh the gases, and so you start with what you know in terms of the mass of the wood or the charcoal, mass of the wood or the carbon. Then you burn it in such in air, and you measure the weight of the gases of the smoke that produced. And by the way in which he did the experiments with accurate balances, he was actually able to demonstrate that if you collect the smoke, the smoke contains gases, first off, that are totally different than ordinary air, but they don't support combustion. They don't support the ability of animals to breathe it. He was also, and that the increase in, and that the if you collected this these gases in the smoke, he demonstrated that by weighing the gases generated from burning a fixed amount of carbon, that the gases weighed more than the carbon or wood you started with. Okay, and that the increase in the weight in the gases produced came out of taking a certain portion out of the air itself. Okay, and he was able to identify what he called oxygen, which is a gas that had been prepared earlier by Joseph Priestley, but Priestley didn't realize it was actually an element that he had created. So with these experiments, particularly of Lavoisier, where people developed the conception, okay, these kinds of chemical transformations, we can account for materially what's going on. We can say we're going to start with so much weight of substance A and substance B, we're going to have some kind of transformation, and we end up with some other material substance C or some combination of substances. And if you weigh the sum of all the weights of everything that you start with, that has to add up to the sum of the weights of everything that you end up with. So that this idea was put forward that matter cannot be created or destroyed, that it is eternal. Now, first off, they were looking at matter from the standpoint of this sense, this idea of what you can touch in terms of this material phenomenon, as I said before. Okay, you know, something that has weight, something you can touch. And while this development was a big advance in man's ability to understand such processes. In another sense, it was not true, okay, because what you're leaving out of it is the question, okay, well, where does this energetic phenomena come from? What's producing the light? What's producing the heat? Okay? You're having an accounting for the material transformations, but what is that? What's the connection of that to the light and the heat? This is Antoine Lavoisier, who was involved in making these discoveries. And also, so this reposes this question again in terms of what is an element, okay, which the way we were looking at it previously, okay, with this development in terms of the discoveries of Lavoisier, there's a sort of certain shift in terms of the way that people were thinking of it, I think, where people were thinking in terms of, okay, an element in terms of, you know, what you can weigh, what you know, much more in terms of the material properties. And what was the conception at that point was, if you take a material substance, okay, and you take some material substance that is homogeneous, it's not like some, you know sand and iron filings mixed together. It's some homogeneous substance which is all the same thing. The idea of an element was that if you take some homogeneous substance and apply it to various procedures to attempt to break it down into simpler components, okay, can you continue to do that indefinitely, or do you come to some sort of limit? Okay, and what Lavoisier said was, how do you define what an element is? Well, that depends on the technologies you can bring to bear on this separation of the homogeneous substance into its simpler components. So, for example, you had, if you take, for example, ocean water, salt water, and you just put a bunch of salt water into a pan, come back the next day, okay, you're left with a big layer of salt, the water's evaporated, so you've separated the water, which is evaporated, from the salt, which is left behind. So have you created an element? Is salt an element? Is water an element? Well, what Lavoisier said is that question depends on the ability of you to have the technology to break these these homogeneous substances into their smaller components, into their component substances. So, in fact, up until about 200 years ago, salt and water were in fact considered, and in terms of the functioning of the human economy, were chemical elements in the sense that they could not be and were not, you know, separated in terms of man's use. Whatever the universe was doing with the salt and water is something different. But in terms of man's ability to knowably change the universe, so I just want to make that point. Just one other thing. Okay. All right, so another interesting anomaly when you look at this question of what an element is, if you look over the course of human history, the number of elements that were known to man and used to man by man, this is, the first category there, this probably the most accurate dating is just the word antiquity. because some of these things might have been discovered much earlier than that, 6,000 BC. We don't know. But so you're talking about seven metals and two elements that are not metals, carbon and sulfur. But an interesting anomaly, which we can get to a little bit later, is that of these known elements from the most ancient times of human society, the only element among the metals that is actually significantly abundant in the Earth's crust is iron, with about 5% abundance in the Earth's crust. If you look at the abundance of elements like gold or tin or lead, you're talking about trace elements. So why is it that man was able to discover these elements in spite of the fact that in the Earth itself, okay, if you look at the average abundance of these elements in terms of if the elements were distributed uniformly out without the Earth, you would never be able to find them. So that's an anomaly, you know, first off, in terms of what kind of world are we living in where man has discovered first some of the elements that are the least abundant on the Earth. So you have, this is what you had in the 13th century, you have another element, arsenic. In the 15th century, you have a couple more, the 17th century. In the 18th century, with the impact of the project launched by Gottfried Leibniz in terms of this idea of political economy, the idea of establishing in Russia, in United States, and other countries around the world, scientific academies, which take up the task of making scientific discoveries, discovering technologies, and developing their nations, you have a whole explosion of discovery of elements. So by the end of the 18th century, I think there's 33 elements. And then by the time Mendeleev is graduating from this pedagogical institute in St. Petersburg, there are about 64 chemical elements. Let's see. Yeah. Now, Mendeleev had a somewhat different approach to this question of defining what an element was than was used by a lot of people up to that time. And it's a conception that goes back to the influence of people like Gottfried Leibniz. He insisted on this idea that the characteristics of particular chemical elements are not something defined internally to the element themselves. Okay, it's something that reflects that each chemical element has characteristics that reflect a universal principle ordering the entire system of all the chemical elements that exist, in a way in which, similar to what Johannes Kepler in his development of the conception that in the planetary orbits, you have the planets traveling around the sun in elliptical orbits. The sun is at one of the foci of the ellipse. And since it's an elliptical orbit, it's not a circular orbit, the planet is speeding up as it approaches the sun, and as it goes away from the sun, it's slowing down. So the thing about this is that every point in the orbit, the planet is doing something different than it did before. Okay, but how does the planet determine what it has to do at every point in the orbit? That is determined by the relationship between all of the planets in a system. Okay, so in other words, the idea of the characteristic of the harmonic characteristics of the planets in the planetary system of Kepler are determined by the harmonics of the entire system, including the idea that. And this came under attack you know, politically from the circles of the people that were promoting Isaac Newton in terms of, you know, stopping this idea, and this whole idea that was imposed politically that no, the universe is not organized harmonically in that sense, but for example, the planets are, you know, the gravity is just, well, it's the mass in the planet, and then the planet is attracting just action at a distance at some other object. That's not the conception that Kepler laid out. The movement of the planet in the orbit is determined harmonically, and so what's causing something to be attracted to the Earth is not some mysterious force. It's the fact that if you tried to move something off the Earth, you're in effect trying to change the tuning of the planet's orbit. In a small degree, so it's like you're trying to, you're in a string quartet and you're trying to go at a different tempo than everybody else. There's a dynamic that prevents you from doing that. So that was what Mendeleev started with from in terms of a conception. So what this meant is that unlike other chemists that would be looking at the chemical elements, and what they were basically doing is they were looking for similarities among the different chemical elements. So they would group them into certain categories of elements that would all have the same kind of properties. You have what are called the alkali metals that are, first of all, metals. They're generally light, soft metals, and they're extremely reactive. If you drop the lithium, sodium, potassium, the ones that you see on the right part side of the screen there, the left part of the screen, in water, they generate hydrogen, and in some cases the reaction is very vigorous and the hydrogen bursts into flame because of the heat. Okay, if you take the halogens, like chlorine, bromine, or fluorine, you have a completely different characteristics. You know, the all of the halogens have properties that are similar to each other, like the alkali metals are similar to each other, but between the groups, the properties are totally different. So what Mendeleev did is he said, I have to have a means of which not just looking at similarities among elements so that I can group them into categories. The question is, what orders these different elements into a system? And he said that that the problem that you have is that you have the characteristic properties of the elements are in many cases ambiguous, in the sense that he said, for example, if you look at lithium, which is one of the metals that we just saw in the last list, and another metal called barium, in some respects these two metals are similar to sodium and potassium, but in other senses they're similar to magnesium and calcium. So he said he stressed that he writes this textbook, The Principles of Chemistry, where he exhaustively looks through all of the properties and the data for all of the known elements. But then he says that all of that data doesn't allow us to determine, you know, to establish the system that determines the ordering of the elements into a system. He insisted that what you needed is some measurable property, some accurately measurable property that was not qualitative but was actually quantitative. And he settled on this question in particular of the atomic weight, which is the idea of an atomic weight in itself is an interesting idea. I mean, the idea of an atom. This was whether such things existed as, you know, small entities that you know, this was a disputed point, you know, whether you describe things in terms of atoms or not. Let's see. Okay, and so he one of the key things, he had this conception that you have an ordering principle of an increase of the atomic weight of the elements, that's what's going to allow you to actually order the elements into a system. He looks at other measurable properties as well, including something called isomorphism, where the idea is that you have, for example, the chemist Mitscherlich in 1820 said that if you compare two different substances, one of them is called phosphoric acid, which has three hydrogens, a phosphorus, and three oxygen, three volumes of oxygen. I mean, the ratio in which the elements combine is, three volumes of hydrogen, three volumes of what's called atomic weights of hydrogen, atomic weights of phosphorus, and atomic weights of oxygen. So three hydrogens, one phosphorus, and three oxygens. And then he says, you look at another material that has three hydrogens, one arsenic instead of phosphorus, and same three hydrogen, oxygen atoms, and you form crystals that are not only similar, but have the property that if you have a mixture of these two substances in solution, you can cause them to form a crystal composed of both substances at the same time. Okay, what he called this idea of isomorphism, and he said that if you have a property like that. That allows you to look at the material and say, well, since the structure of the arrangement of the atoms in the material is the same, the only difference is that in one case you have arsenic and the other case you have phosphorus. This allows you to create a situation where you say, well, there must be a similarity among the arsenic and the phosphorus, since you have the crystals are the same and they have this property of isomorphism. So applying this and method, what he develops in terms of his first attempt at this. On this chart here, if you look down here, these are the elements that he's looking at. So these are the three elements we saw previously, lithium, sodium, and potassium, the alkali metals, very reactive metals. So he starts with the lightest element, lithium, and then orders them according to increasing atomic weight. Okay, so you see it going across Be, which is beryllium, B is boron, C is carbon, N is nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, and so forth. And then the next element, sodium, all of a sudden is an element that has the same kind of properties as lithium. And then the next element is magnesium, which is similar to beryllium. And so each of these vertical columns consist of groups where the elements in the vertical column are similar to each other. And the other thing that is apparent is that if you compare the kind of compounds that these elements make, at the top of the chart there, you have R2O, where R is just a symbol standing for, it could be any one of the elements in that row. So elements in this first column, you have two atoms of the metal combining with one atom of the oxygen. So you could have, for example, lithium, 2, oxygen. In the next element, you have a different characteristic of the oxides. You have one atom of the metal to one atom of the oxygen. So you have like calcium oxide, CaO, or lime. Okay, and going across, what you see is an increasing ability for the element to bind to other elements. So you have you have the first sort of indication of a periodic system that he was developing, where by ordering the elements according to increasing atomic weight, you're able to take elements in a certain column and say, well, if there was another element here below aluminum, then it should have properties determined similarly to the other elements in that same group.
Ask a question.
Yeah?
Are you saying that if you have, let's say the first column, if you have lithium, like two elements of lithium and oxygen,
right,
that there's a similarity with that and, let's say, Na2O?
Yeah. Yeah, all of the elements in that column have the same formula. They will have two atoms of the metal to one atom of the oxygen. The next column will have one atom of metal to one atom of oxygen. Okay. All right. So this is in the same paper that he publishes in 1869, where I had the chart I just showed you, where he looks more broadly at the known chemical elements. Okay, so you have hydrogen, lithium, then he's ordering them according to increasing atomic weight, increasing atomic weight going down here, but then also ordering them according to, as you saw before, in terms of their combining power. So you see the same kind of thing that you saw before: lithium, sodium, potassium. Rubidium is another metal in that same alkali metal series. So he develops this whole ordering principle. And then what he does is he looks at the cases where he has elements that are not yet discovered. There's a gap between calcium and this element, 56, here. And he forecasts that the atomic weight of that element should be 45, and also by looking at the characteristics of the elements that it's close to, determines what the properties should be. This is an element that's later discovered called scandium, which had properties very, very similar to what Mendeleev said. You have also similarly here, there's a gap in the table of boron, aluminum, and then this gap where he said, okay, we have these elements that are close to it, so every element in this series is similar, certain chemical similarities, and then also the elements on either side have a change in properties, qualitative change in properties that is reflected in the increase of the atomic weight. So by looking at the elements in the same group, in the same line here, and looking at the elements before and after in terms of atomic weight, he forecasts what the properties of the element should be, what kind of oxides it formed, what kind of compounds with hydrogen and so forth, a whole sort of fingerprint of what you're looking for, and then this was an element that was later discovered with properties very similar to what he said, similarly here with carbon, silicon, and a missing element. Okay, now the other thing that Mendeleev did, which shocked and in some cases probably infuriated other chemists of his time, because he's approaching this from a different standpoint than other people. He's not just looking at the known data on the elements and saying, I've got to categorize these according to various groups. He's saying there's got to be an underlying principle ordering all of this, and the idea that the characteristics of any particular element are not something determined inside the element, but it's a harmonic feature of the entire system. And so the properties of any element are determined not only by the elements that you know, but also by all the elements that exist but that you don't know. So this is why he did things that nobody else did in terms of forecasting what the elements would be. And also what he did is he took many of the elements. For example, you have...
Where is it here?
You have a thorium. Okay, and he said, well, look, thorium, this atomic weight has got to be wrong. Okay, because it doesn't fit in according to its atomic weight. So I'm just going to change the atomic weight. So he changes the atomic weight from 118 to 232. And that's essentially what it is. The same thing with uranium.
And he was right.
Yeah, he was right.
What was the new number he gave?
Yeah, he changed it from 118 to about 232.
232.
Yeah, a big change. In the case of uranium, he increased it by over double. And part of the reason for this discrepancy is that this question of what a particular substance would bind to. I mean, what you're able to measure is you take a certain weight of one element, it combines exactly with a certain weight of another element. Okay, but the question is it one atom of element A combining with one atom of element B? Is element A existing in a form where you have two elements of two atoms of element A combining with one element of the element B. Anyway, there was confusion over this, where, and he basically said that the system is determining this, and I'll just show you in the next chart. Okay, this is the final periodic table that he publishes. This is in his textbook, the fifth edition of his Principles of Chemistry, which I've sort of reworked the table. We're just keeping all of the atomic weights that he had, keeping the same position of the element in the groups, and then just the only change from what he had is this question of the nature of the periodicity. I mean, you see, in the first column, you have hydrogen, unknown at the time of... let me show you this instead, actually. Maybe better. Yeah, this is better. Okay, so this is basically the periodic table as recognized today, where you have, these are the alkali metals that we saw before. The next one over are the, what we call the alkaline earths, okay? All of these elements here, what are called the transition metals, were known to Mendeleev and ordered in the proper order. Similarly here, okay, all of these elements over here, it's going off the screen, I think, here. Yeah, I'm going to get the whole chart there, sorry. That's the whole chapter. Now, what wasn't known to Mendeleev at his day, because these elements had not yet been discovered, is this row here, this column here, what are called the noble gases. One of them had helium, the lightest one, had been detected by spectroscopic means by looking at the sun, but it was disputed whether this was actually an element. All of these other gases were discovered, in the 20, 30 years after Mendeleev's discovery. But basically the structure of the periodic table as existed today was known to Mendeleev, except for one feature that he didn't recognize, is this idea that you have the top row, you have two elements in the period, hydrogen and helium. Then you have the next two rows have eight elements, lithium across to neon and sodium across to argon. Then the next two rows have actually, it appears to, you add these transition metals, so you have 2 + 6 + 10, so it's 18. And then the next two rows are 18 plus what's down here, these two here. So you have the periodicities are actually, the first is two, and then two rows of eight, another two rows of 18, another two rows of 34. Okay, now the actual understanding of what's behind that, were discoveries that were made later. But basically what came out of this in terms of it laid by laying essentially a roadmap for the development of all of these missing elements in a system, Mendeleev was able to say, okay, we have to go out and by developing the resources of Russia, find the materials that we know are there that will have properties that will allow us to actually transform Russia for the better. So it created a whole explosion of scientific discoveries, including one of the questions that was asked, because at the time of Mendeleev, the last known element, this is going off the chart, was uranium. Let's see, put it down here. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. The last known element at the time of Mendeleev was uranium. And you had all of these elements in the periodic table that were just gaps in the system. In addition to the three that I pointed out, there were a whole bunch of other ones. So people got the idea, well, how come the periodic table stops at uranium? Is it possible that we could actually generate heavier elements if we bombarded uranium with neutrons? And in the effort to do that, they created the conditions under which you had nuclear fission. So that's the sort of nonlinear things that came out of these discoveries. And all of these elements after uranium are elements that were created artificially. All of them after uranium are radioactive. Uranium itself also is radioactive, of course.
Are you saying that all these other elements were created through the bombarding of uranium?
They were created. I don't have to look in terms of they were created in like particle accelerators where you actually build up. I would look. I have to look at the particular
they
details.
They're
artificially created. They're not. They don't exist in nature.
Yeah. Well, plutonium is definitely created out of uranium. Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 You shoot a proton into the nucleus of uranium?
No, a neutron.
A neutron? Okay.
Yeah.
And from there you get plutonium, but for the rest, not the area.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Bob, did you say that they discovered fission in the process, having made the hypothesis that they were going to add neutrons to uranium?
Yeah, you had people that were thinking that they were making elements of heavier atomic weight than uranium. In fact, what they were looking at was the breaking up of the uranium nucleus, and this was not really clarified for a certain period of time. But the point is that by posing this question of why is uranium the heaviest element in the table, in a system where just put this other chart back on before. Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, this is Mendeleev's periodic table, and you see, as I was saying before, this is sort of turned around the other way, but you have all of these elements are essentially ordered by Mendeleev in the correct positions, but then you also have all these gaps, which he left as gaps. So in addition to these red elements are the ones I was telling before that were gaps in the system, but they're successive elements. There's, you know, potassium, the atomic weight of 39, calcium, atomic weight of 40. Then he said there's a gap here, the next element, because what comes after it is 48. He said, well, the next element that doesn't exist yet, but's got to be there, has to have an atomic weight of 44 approximately, which was discovered later as scandium. But in this case, you have a whole, you know, over a dozen elements that are missing, okay, that were discovered later. So you basically have, and because it exists in a periodic system where you're saying, okay, if the element is in this position of the table, that gives me a clue in terms of what its properties should be. It's sort of like having a map to go and find where the treasure is. And so it created the conditions to totally transform the situation. The entries here in blue are the cases where Mendeleev totally changed the atomic weight. So as you can see, I mean, uranium, and changed that to 240, a big, big change in atomic weight. So it's this idea that there's a system underlying the entire system of the periodic table of the elements, and that the element is, the properties are not something determined internally, but it's a function of the entire system. Is what? Anyway. Yeah, now, I didn't have enough time to prepare the slides for it, but one of the students of Mendeleev, Vladimir Vernadsky, looks at this whole question of the periodic table from a different standpoint. Because in one sense, if you think about what Mendeleev does, he's looking at the periodic functions of the chemical elements. In one sense, from their looking at their reactions chemically, it's a function of the lithosphere in terms of what are the interreactions of these chemicals among other elements in the lithosphere. What Vernadsky does is he says that you have three different phase spaces in the universe, as people have probably heard Mr. LaRouche refer to before. You have non-living processes in the universe, what he called the abiotic. Then you have living processes that cannot be explained by simply abiotic processes. And then you have the cognitive capability of the human mind that exists as a third principle level. And so Vernadsky approaches it from the standpoint of, what is the, he defines the idea that the living processes are transforming the non-living world, okay? And that you have living organisms, beginning actually with the process of photosynthesis. You have the light coming from the sun, the green matter in plants, chlorophyll, transforming light, you know, into plant matter using carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to create plant matter that animals and human beings depend on for food. Okay, so he develops this conception that living processes on the Earth and the biosphere as a whole is a singularity in a process. Generated not simply from the sun, but he calls it a cosmic phenomena. Okay, that living organisms are engaged in what he calls a biogenic migration of atoms. So as an animal or human being that eats food, okay, the elements in the food that you're consuming, the air that you breathe, okay, you're continuously changing the atoms in the physical makeup of your biology. Okay, the atoms are sort of passing through your biology like molecules of water through a whirlpool, and yet there's a dynamic process that maintains your existence as an organism. Okay, And that the effect of these processes of this biogenic migration of atoms is to transform the lithosphere over geological time frames, developing things like taking an atmosphere, which at one point did not have oxygen in it, and through photosynthetic processes generating an oxygen-rich atmosphere. And this became a force that actually changed the entire geology also of the planet. You had the generation of oxygen from microorganisms in water. The oxygen in the water created the situation where iron all of a sudden was no longer soluble in the water and precipitate out. And then you had, as a result of biological activity, ores that were accessible later to mankind in a concentrated way. So Vernadsky looks at this whole question of the effect of life on transforming the biosphere and looks at this idea of a periodic table. You know, what are the different categories of elements in terms of what are their effect on living processes? So from that standpoint, what Lynn is now proposing, there are other implications that that Matt is going to talk about that we haven't. That I haven't got enough time to go through it right now, but that begins to move you in the direction of what Lynn is talking about in terms of this idea of what are the effect of cosmic radiation on living processes. And Matt can
we'll take over a here. Couple of questions while I hook up my PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
This slide with the sun setting up, and you talked about astronomy and the relationship of that with the four elements you showed. What was it about?
Well, this idea of what are the principles that organize the universe? If you think of in terms of the development of understanding of transformations on Earth in terms of like chemical transformations, you could look at it as the Earth, air, fire, and water. In one sense, in terms of the physical states of the solid, liquid, gas, and energetic phenomena. But then this is not just something confined to the Earth. I mean, the question is what would be the corresponding question in terms of these principles elsewhere in the universe, I would think would be the question of development of an idea of astronomy. I mean, visually you see, something that looks like fire, rising in the sky, the sun, rising into the air, you have the land, you have the water. What's the principles that order this? I mean, maybe it's not a good, an accurate reflection or not.
It's okay. No book.
No.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, I wasn't sure when you answered my question if I got my answer.
Huh?
But was it an accident when they discovered the issue?
I have to. I have to go back and. I mean, it was this question of developing the elements heavier than uranium. They set out to do that.
Yeah.
And then they created different elements that they assumed were heavier than uranium.
Yeah.
And that's what they assumed because that's what they were trying to do. But in terms of the idea was that the nucleus of the atom is something that cannot be broken apart. Okay, so the idea that the uranium, it might emit radioactive particles, but the idea that it could break in half was something unheard of.
Okay, this came from the development of the four cent elements, with phosphorus. So the question is how this can continue emitting light over years, where the energy which creates the light is coming from.
Okay.
So the question of the power of this element was a big mystery for a certain period of time, which helped, with development of the Marie Curie. you know, a better understanding of the nuclear process. They discover a different form of radiation, but this is no longer visible light, but you have alpha particles, beta particles, and gamma particles. And then they start getting conception of the nucleus, and that way, you know, they can conception of the structure of the element which is destroying itself, which is no anymore, you know, something which is eternal and fixed, but something which is changing over time. That was a big pick out because they discover and actually improve this to the case. And they say, okay, can we create something out of the parts? Can we get some new elements? So this is the conception which went into the development.
Okay. So
I have a problem.
To take this down,